supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Today's the second part of our series on depression, and we're going to be talking about depression in families. From the outside, the Gallaghers looked like the picture-perfect family. John Gallagher was a successful financial analyst. His wife, Patricia, and their three children were engaged in their suburban community. But on the inside, things didn't look so bright. John was irritable. He couldn't sleep. He suffered weight loss. But he wouldn't or couldn't talk about what was going on with him. In 1999, he attempted suicide, but the family didn't discuss what happened. Friends and relatives, they didn't know either. The family started to fall apart. Everybody was suffering in silence. Now, 9 years later, John and his family had begun to tell their story after reading about a student who tried to commit suicide. John wanted to help others, but has found that talking about depression has helped him and his family. The Gallaghers join us today, and I want to thank all four of you for being here. Let me start with you, John. Say hi.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Good. And John's wife, Patricia.
Right. Good
welcome.
Morning. Good morning, Dan.
And the two daughters, Caitlin.
Good morning.
Hi, Caitlin. Hi. And Robin.
Hi, good morning, Dan.
Good morning. We're also joined by Dr. David Michlowitz. He's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of Colorado. He joins us by telephone from Oxford University. He's the author of Bipolar Disorder, a Family-Focused Treatment Approach. David, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hello to everybody.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Our phone number, if you want to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If you've had depression or if you've loved one, family members had depression, give us a call. So, John, let's start with you. We know that your suicide attempt took place 8 years ago, but tell us about your life several years before that. What was going on?
I think, Dan, what led to that situation was there was a tremendous amount of stress going on in the workplace. I was working for a pharmaceutical company, and they were continually talking about reorganizing and downsizing. And in my department, I would be called in to my manager, and she would continually say that we have to let people go. And I think that led to a lot of stress.
How about, take us back even before that. Take us back 5 years before that. What were you like? What was your life like? What kind of guy were you?
Well, I think my problem was my inability to cope effectively with stress. I was pretty much genetically predisposed too stressed. My mother died when I was 9, and I found out later that she actually died from depression. She actually drank to try to cover her depression. Mm. But I think it stems back to the fact that I was genetically predisposed to it.
And then you had these stressors.
Yes.
at work. Any other sources of stress in your life besides work? Not that that's not enough.
I think it was a combination of factors. I think it was stress in the workplace, the genetic part of it.
How were things at home?
Things at home were relatively stormy because my wife and I, I was working quite a bit of hours at work, and if I wasn't home, that put my wife gave my wife a lot of pressure with the children. So I was kind of pulled. I was pulled from with work, and I was pulled at home to try to make ends meet.
Patricia, tell us. When you saw things begin to unravel with John, what you saw, tell us what it was like for you.
Well, the first time I noticed anything was in 1990, so that was 9 years before he really had depression. And he woke up one night and he felt like he was panicking. He wanted me to take him to St. Mary's for a heart attack. And when I called our primary, they said, just tell him to relax and come and visit us in the morning. So that was one event that kind of passed. And then there was another time when the stress of our fourth child, we have a son, Ryan, about a month before Ryan was born, John just had that attack in the middle of the night again, and went to work and came home at noon and stayed out of work for 3 days. And I remember walking around Core Creek Park with him just thinking, oh, my God, I'm not going to have a husband when this baby's born. But that passed. And then it came again when John was being let go from the job, and or he thought he was. And he was just so panic-stricken about not being able to provide for the family. So it was about 13 months of him going through a depression that wasn't diagnosed. Like, I never even thought of the word depression.
What was happening with you?
I think I was getting pretty mad at him because I was getting upset that he would come home from work and he would be very negative and irritable. He would tell me that he wanted me to call and look up some jobs for him and make some phone calls and send out resumes. And I'm thinking, wait, I've got to do homework with the kids and take them to other activities. And when you come home, you just want to sleep.
Did your marriage feel in jeopardy?
Our marriage had kind of been in jeopardy about a year before that because we were going to counseling. But actually, the 13 months before, our marriage was okay, but I was so worried about John's health because he wasn't acting the same. Actually, he was very sickly. He had lost a lot of weight. He was always worrying about food. He was going to the doctors several times a week. So my husband wasn't the same husband for those 13 months, but I didn't know what it was.
David, you've been listening to this story. I see when I see marital conflict, what I'm seeing underneath is that one spouse has depression, and that's the underlying cause of marital conflict. Is that frequently the case?
That happens very frequently, yes. And actually, it can be very difficult to tell the cause and effect. You can have depression that leads to marital conflict. You can have marital conflict that either causes depression or exacerbates depression that's already there. We don't always know until we take a thorough history which one caused the other, but in some ways it doesn't matter because the two tend to make each other worse.
And of course, the depression has to be treated for the marriage to be resolved.
The depression has to be treated, but often we recommend working with the family as well, especially after the person's depression has started to subside. There often are marital and family issues that follow a depressive episode that need to be resolved.
Caitlin, let's bring you into this story. Your story begins with your father waking you up every morning, same time, same way. It was a matter of routine, and then he drove you to school.
Right. Every morning my dad would drive me. I had singing, I had chorus practice, and so I relied on him, and that was our time we spent together, about 5 or 10 minutes driving to school.
You said that the discussion stopped at one point in the car, that your father stopped talking, and I want to capture what you said. You said you began to feel like a burden to him in that silence. First you blamed yourself, and then you were angry at him, and then you tried to convince yourself it was no big deal. Tell us about what was happening inside of you during those silences.
I can't really explain it, except that I started to take things rather personally.
How old were you?
13, 14, junior high. I cared about what everybody thought.
Of course.
And being my father, the car rides before were, how was school? Are you excited for this? The field trip, you know, normal conversations. And it eventually turned to silence. And my dad wouldn't talk. He would just drop me off. And I guess that felt awkward to me, and I thought maybe he was mad at me for something.
And then what? I mean, what did you do with that inside your head?
I think I adjusted to my dad's moods. So when my dad would drop me off and he was quiet and moody, I became quiet and moody. I didn't want to seem too happy around him for whatever reason. So that would affect my day.
When you look back, did you become depressed during that time?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe not then, but gradually, yes.
In a way, you're almost describing yourself as becoming depressed in order to accommodate. You said you didn't want to be too happy in front of your dad.
Right. I think it's because I don't really know why I did that, but I find myself still to this day, if someone's happy, I will try to be happy. But my dad, I think as soon as my moods would escalate, I knew that I would just be let down again.
What do you mean?
I knew that if I was in a good mood and my dad would yell at me or yell at my mom or my sisters or brothers because he was so irritable, I think if I started to feel better, I would just, it would hurt me so much to just drop to a sadness again.
You had to
so
be.
So I just wanted to stay the same all the time.
You had to be small.
Right.
Your emotions had to be small.
Yes.
Your needs, your interests, that makes sense. That was your way of being a cooperative member of a family.
I didn't want to ask for too much. I didn't want to start trouble. I just wanted to kind of hide a little bit.
Robin, let me turn to you now. You're the oldest. You describe yourself as the most responsible one. Tell us what was happening with you, inside of you, as you were watching your father's condition deteriorate.
I think, when my dad was going through all this, I tended to just kind of act like nothing was happening. You know, everything was the same, everything was good. I just, I wanted my family to be, the perfect family. And
well, at the risk of sounding like a psychologist here.
Yes.
That's what you were doing. Tell us what you were feeling inside while you
were... I think I just focused on school and my friends and my activities, and I just kind of suppressed all of that anxiety that was going on in my family, and I just, I didn't want to deal with it.
You held it in?
I held it all in.
Was there a point, being the responsible one, where you began to blame yourself for the problems?
No, I never blamed myself.
Huh.
No.
So did you feel a sense of responsibility for the younger sibs to make people happy on track?
Yes.
Did you ever ask your mother what was going on?
I think, did I ask my mother what was going on? I think we actually blamed my mom in the beginning. We said, let our dad sleep. He had a hard day at work. Just let him sleep, let him relax. And she was saying, John, you have to do this and, take the kids here and do this. And we said, Mom, give Dad a break. And I think in the beginning we did blame our mom. Yeah.
So, David, let me turn to you.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are seeing here is family dynamics that sound, I would imagine, pretty common. We've got one person who's kind of dropping out of the system with depression, a wife who's confused and angry and feels burdened, two kids who are confused and don't know what to do, don't know who to blame.
This is certainly, the patterns that are being described are certainly ones I've seen before, and I think much of this comes, and it doesn't have a simple explanation, of course, but much of it comes from not knowing what to attribute the depression to. What they're describing is irritability, withdrawal, kind of a sad, low affect, negative thinking, and it's really hard for families to know, is this an illness? Is this a change in personality? Is this stress? Or is it somebody else's fault? And I think it's not at all clear when someone becomes depressed what you're supposed to do or how you're supposed to understand that behavior. And the responses that people had are very understandable in the circumstances.
And the suffering that goes on when this happens, we know can be pretty long-lasting, if not permanent.
It's very difficult for the person with the depression and for the family. Because, again, people don't know what's causing it. It may take a while to find an appropriate treatment. People tend to feel guilty, thinking they caused it, or to be angry at other family members. And there can be a long trajectory before the family really comes back to the way it was before the depression occurred.
Yeah, and as we both know, David, everything changes once we have that label.
Yes.
You know, that's a life-altering thing to have in your possession. We're gonna come back. We're gonna talk about that fateful day when you were hospitalized, John, and you made your suicide attempt, and what happened to the family, and what's happened in the wake of that, the treatment, the family breakup, and how a family reconstituted. We're talking about depression in the family, and we're talking about it specifically with the Gallagher family, John, Patricia. John's got a history of depression. Patricia's his wife, and daughters, Robin and Caitlin. We are hearing their story here on Voices in the Family. We're also joined on the telephone by Dr. David Michlowitz. He's on the phone with us from Oxford University. He's the author of Bipolar Disorder, A Family-Focused Treatment Approach. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. If you've had depression in your family, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
For 13 years, Reverend Carol Pickett was the death house chaplain at the Walls Prison Unit in Huntsville, Texas. He ministered to 95 inmates who were put to death by lethal injection, including the inmate who was given the world's first lethal injection. Pickett is now an opponent of the death penalty and the subject of the documentary At the Death House Door on the IFC Network. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. We are talking about the impact of depression on the family. We're here with the Gallaghers, John, Patricia's wife, Robin, and Caitlin, his daughters. John has a long history of depression, culminating with a suicide attempt in 1999. We're talking with the family. They have decided to open up and share their story with the larger community in an effort to help others who are suffering with depression. I'm also joined by Dr. David Michlowitz. He's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at University of Colorado, and he joins us from Oxford University. He's written Bipolar Disorder, A Family-Focused Treatment Approach. John, let's go back to you. Now, as the story unfolds, you tried unsuccessfully to get help for your panic attacks, for your insomnia. You were kind of in and out of hospitals. But then in 1999, you were in a medical unit of a hospital on the third floor. Patricia brought you some family photo albums in an effort to make you feel better, but it really had the opposite effect. Tell us what happened that day.
Yeah, I think my wife came into the room and, you know, tried to comfort me with the pictures of the way life used to be. And again, it did have an opposite effect on me, because I thought to myself that I'll never be able to relive those times again. And I think when everything just kind of took a toll on me, all of the sleeplessness, the worry, the anxiety, the chemical imbalance, the ability or the inability to function on a daily basis, all those things filled up in me, and I just couldn't take life any longer.
What did you do?
I then asked my wife to go to ask her mother to bring me some clothes. She left the room, and I saw that the window was ajar, and I didn't think of anybody in the family. I just thought that I couldn't take life any longer, and I hurled myself out the window.
What happened medically, first of all?
After I jumped, when I hit the ground, I miraculously landed on my legs. I had my legs were completely crushed. I had head, arm, and face abrasions. I remember when I was in the ambulance, they were cutting my jeans, and they said that he has tremendous bone fractures and so forth.
In the ensuing days, did you regret that you didn't die?
Yes. I did, because I didn't want to go through all those symptoms again. I didn't want to continue to go through the sleeplessness and the anxiety and the worry and the heart palpitations. It was just emotionally too much for me to take care of. It was just totally overwhelming.
How long, John, before you were happy that you didn't die?
Well, thankfully, Dr. Worthington, the psychiatrist, tried several antidepressants on me, and the one that seemed to work was Celexa. And the antidepressant takes about 3 weeks to kick in, so I was pretty irritable and frustrated up, I guess, three to four weeks through that point.
Patricia, I'd like to take you back to that day. I mean, it was a pretty eerie report that you wrote when you said you heard on the intercom after you walked out of the room, there's an emergency in room, whatever room John was in. Mm-hmm. What was that like for you when you heard that?
Well, actually, I brought John the photo album and a Scrabble game to kind of cheer him up, and almost right away he asked me to call my mother. So when I went to the nurse's station to call my mother, actually it was another visitor in the hallway screamed, "Was there a patient in room 318? He just jumped out the window. And I looked at that window and looked at him laying down there, and I just honestly couldn't believe my eyes.
And you were in shock.
I couldn't believe it. I mean, here's a guy that was such a worrywart. If we were at the shore, he didn't want the kids too close to the railing of the boardwalk. Here's somebody that didn't want them to go out deep in the ocean, and he jumped out a window. I really couldn't believe it. I was in total shock, and I remember them saying, "Call 911, call 911." I'm thinking, can't you bring him back into the hospital? But they said since it happened outside the hospital, they had to take him somewhere else.
What happened to you the shock, of course, that first moment you saw him, but what happened to you in the hours after that happened when you realized that your husband tried to kill himself?
Well, they wouldn't let me see him, and then they asked what faith I was, and then they put me in a room with a Catholic priest, and I really thought that he had died. And the craziest first thought was, okay, God, I guess that's the only way you could take him out of this pain. Like, I was almost like accepting he had to die. I couldn't imagine that he had lived, because he had fallen not only to the cement but to a viaduct, which gave him another 5 or 6 feet. So I really thought he was dead. And when I got to Abington Trauma, I remember asking the nurse, and she said, "We believe his injuries are life-threatening." So I really didn't think that I would see him again.
Caitlin, how did you find out?
Well, I was with my sister and a friend, and we just went out for pizza, came back home, and I got a phone call from a neighbor saying, "Get dressed, I'm going to pick you up in 2 minutes, your dad's in the hospital." And that's it. And we didn't hear why. I guess we couldn't have ever thought that something like this would have happened, so I thought maybe it was something with his heart. Something small. So my neighbor came and picked us up, and my sister and I went out, got in the car, and my neighbor sped to the hospital. And we just saw, when we pulled in, we saw my grandfather crying his eyes out and shaking. And we knew that wasn't good, because we've never seen my grandfather cry in our whole life.
When, Hal, did you find out?
Well, then I think he might have told us, or I don't recall, but he might have told us, or we went into the hospital, saw my mom, my relatives, and they said, everyone crying and shaking said, "Daddy jumped out of the window."
What happened to you that minute when you heard that?
My heart crumbled. I was speechless. I didn't know what to say. I thought he died. And I thought I would never see him again. I'll never touch him again. My dad's gone. Why would he do that? 50 questions went through my head.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
I couldn't control a single one.
Robin, tell us about you. You got the news the same time Caitlin did.
Yeah, that's correct.
So the story must be the same, but tell me what happened inside of you when you realized what your father had done.
When I was in the chapel, the visiting area, I was with my sister, and our family was there, and I just looked at my mom, and my mom said, "Daddy jumped out the window." And I just thought, what? No, that didn't happen. Dad would never do that. He didn't even go on the roller coasters with us. He was afraid of heights. How could he jump out the window? And it just was like, it was really like a dream. It was like a nightmare, actually, because we just looked at our mom, and Caitlin and I just grabbed each other, and we just held each other tight, and we were just sobbing, and we said, what? We don't believe this. So it was really hard.
Listening to your voice and looking at your face, there's still emotions there, obviously.
I think this is probably maybe the third time that I've actually had to recall that and really think about it, because I just acted like it never happened. I never told anyone.
How long did you keep it quiet?
Until my parents told me that I had to write something down.
How long was that?
About a month ago.
What was that like all those years? What did you do?
It was like a family secret that was just something that we never talked about. And, you know, if anyone asked our father, he was in a car accident. You know, he fell down the stairs. We never said anything.
What was it like that first time you wrote?
I couldn't do it. It took me about 3 weeks to actually write it down.
Why?
Because it was something that I never wanted to go back and relive.
And now that you have several times?
Now it's good. I think I'm starting to heal now. And now that my family has come out, it seems like it's all right. It's okay. And we're trying to help other people who've been dealing with this, because I would never want it to happen to anyone.
Yeah, and it does. I want to talk to David and get his reaction. But before I do, John, what's this like for you right now, right here, listening to your daughters?
I think I'm so happy at this point, because I really honestly feel that my family is healing the way they should have healed a long time ago. And it was my fault for not really talking about this and really talking about it in depth, because of the shame factor, I think.
Yeah, of course, the shame factor. Patricia, did you feel the shame also?
I used to say that we didn't want to talk about it because John would never want to talk about it. But as I really reflected on it, I didn't want anyone to know either. I remember that there was a house about four houses down a few years before that a man had committed suicide. And I just remember when I walked past that house, I would just kind of close my eyes, because I thought, why would anybody want to commit suicide? And then when it happened to me, I only told my friend Claire and my friend Nancy. We never told our cousins and our aunts or our uncles. We told everybody the same lie.
Let me ask you the same question I just asked John. You just heard your daughters. I know you've heard them before talk about that day and their reactions. What's it like for you as you listen to that?
I'm so glad that they're sharing that, because they really haven't talked about it. And whenever we would try to talk about it, never in the depth that they're sharing now. And we've all had a lot of problems over the years, and we've all acted out in different ways, me, the kids, and it's all because we're not being honest with each other about the most important thing in our life. So how can we be honest about other things?
It's sad, painful, difficult watching, as a father of two daughters, watching your daughters as they talk about it, the pain they obviously are experiencing. I'm watching, having difficulty breathing because the emotions are so powerful. It feels, it's sad, it's hard, it's hard to watch, and I know this is part of the healing process, is when you take the scab off of wounds and expose them to air, you know, that's when the healing starts. David, talk to us, please, about secrets in the family. Mm-hmm. The story we're hearing, even this is not unusual, yes?
Yes, it's not unusual. This is a very moving story that we're hearing. And I must say, I think the Gallagher family has come a very long way in dealing with this issue. What they've described is very right after the event is very common among families, a sense of shock, speechlessness, like it's a nightmare, this disbelief. How could anybody do this? I'm never going to see my dad again. Nothing's ever going to be the same. But I think there's a numbness that takes over right at the beginning. And as time goes on, sometimes in some families that turns into anger. Why would he do this to us? How could he turn his back on us like that? And then sometimes people feel guilt as time goes on. Maybe I may cause this to happen. A whole range of emotions people go through over time. But one of the things that really strikes a chord with me is a sense of isolation the family felt right after the event. The family secret, the sense of shame, is very palpable in families. The stigma, how do we talk about this? It's okay to talk about a physical accident or a car accident or a medical problem, but suicide, that's much harder to talk about. And I think the family's doing the right thing by being open about it and also by trying to help other people. I think one of the ways you come to terms with an event like this is to help other people who are going through the same thing. So my hat is really off to them.
Yeah, and that's research shows that that's the best way to get through anything is
yes.
to turn it to for the greater good and
yes.
to help other
Although
people.
I think it's fair to say there's an evolutionary process first. People can't do this right away. They have to come to terms with it themselves first and try to understand their own emotions and develop a framework for why it happened, and then they can share that framework with other people.
David, my favorite Sufi saying is, when the heart weeps for what it's lost, the soul rejoices for what it's found. Mm-hmm. But first you weep, and you weep, and you weep for a long time until you're done weeping.
And I think that's a good point, because sometimes people try to shut off the emotions too quickly. And you know, we have to just get past this and pretend it didn't happen and move forward. And that can take its own toll.
All right. Well, let's take a short break. We're going to find out what this wonderful family did for themselves and for one another. And David, I want to talk about some family-oriented treatment that you do that has a pretty impressive results and protocol. We're talking with the Gallaghers. You've heard some of their very poignant story, John, Patricia, Robin, and Caitlin. As we just heard, John made a suicide attempt in 1999. The family was silent about it for a long time because of shame. And like I said, when we come back, we're going to hear more about what happened after that. You just heard Dr. David Michalowicz. He's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of Colorado. He joins us on the telephone from Oxford University, and he's written Bipolar Disorder, a Family-Focused Treatment Approach. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Straight from the web to your radio, our panel of bloggers take on the hot topics.
When the IRS is going after them, they want to call it a witch hunt.
It's an insult to assume that a person is genetically predisposed to vote for a certain candidate.
Definitely the beating was excessive.
It's actually time to keep extending equal marriage rights.
I'm Tony Cox. Join us for the Bloggers Roundtable next time on News and Notes from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
Shut up and let me go. Hey!
The Ting Tings have a debut album, an international concert tour, even an iPod commercial.
Not bad for a band whose biggest show last year was in their living room.
All these great gigs that people are asking us to play. Just a shame there's not more hours in the day to do them.
How the Ting Tings became the next big thing.
It's really surreal.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Welcome back to Voices from the Family. We are talking about depression and its impact on the family. We've been talking with the Gallaghers, John, Patricia, Robin, and Caitlin, John's got a history of severe depression. We're also joined by Dr. David Michlewitz, and he's on the phone with us from Oxford University. He's written Bipolar Disorder, a family-focused treatment approach. In the wake of all that happened in 1999, things didn't get better in the marriage, Patricia. These things rarely help marriages. And you lived together for 18 months, and then you asked him to move out.
Actually, I was going to the therapist. John really didn't want to go to therapy. You know, he would go, the kids would go, we'd all go for a little bit, but nobody wanted to stay in it for the long haul. And the therapist that I was going to said, Tricia, I'm looking at your eyes, and your children need at least one healthy parent. You're going to have to make a hard decision. And she said, I can see you going down too. So that's when I said to John, we need space. And he went to live with his sister, who lived about a mile away, and the kids and I stayed in the house for a little while longer.
Anybody listening would say, my God, that's cold-hearted. How could you do that to this man? Did you feel guilty?
I didn't feel guilty at that point because for a year and a half, you know, we had done everything we could physically. And John was walking and driving and everything. The only part that wasn't right was that I felt that he needed to go to therapy and maybe change his medication because he really didn't want to be that involved with the family. And I felt like the kids and I just needed some normalcy.
Caitlin, what was it like for you when you're, well, first before your dad moved out, what was life like that year and a half?
I don't remember very much of that year and a half. I think I spent a lot of time at my friends' houses and just away from home. I remember being angry at my mom for being so cold-hearted and really hurt about the decision that they were separating. And
did you feel protective of your dad?
For some reason, yeah, I did, even though I didn't really feel like I had a great relationship with him at that time. I didn't really know. I think I was mad at both of them, and I held on to that grudge.
Were you still doing what you were doing in the car when your dad was quiet, still keeping your emotions quiet, keeping yourself small and quiet in the family?
I think so, but at the same time, I think because my mom didn't tell many people about what had happened with my dad to her friends or family, I felt a sense of maturity that I had to grow old really quick. So even though I was quiet, I took a lot of it in. My mom would talk to me about things that were going on with my dad and separating and just adult issues about his chemical imbalance and depression, how we have to get better, how we have to talk these things out. I didn't want to talk to her or anybody. I was really upset and I just...
Angry.
Yeah, I didn't want to deal with it. I think I just cried a lot. That was my way of...
You had said that what was happening in the family felt like cancer.
Yeah. It was polluting my body. I would cry at school. I would cry at home. I would cry in the shower before going to bed until I just ran out after a while. And I felt depressed ever since then. And I had gone to therapy. I'd read a lot of self-help books, even at like 16, 17. I wanted to get better. I just thought it was a lost cause. I thought at 17, I wouldn't ever feel that happy again.
How about now?
There's spurts. Every day it's different. I guess I'm happy for the most part, but I have a lot in my life that I look back upon and get really upset about why my parents didn't choose to do things differently, why I didn't cope better, why I decided to hang around other people that were depressed.
Are these really questions or are they accusations? Are you blaming parents? Are you blaming yourself? You're beating everybody up?
I think I've taken turns blaming each person up a fair amount and then giving the rest to myself, and now Now I realize maybe I wouldn't have been so upset with them if I felt better about the way I handled things.
Or you getting treatment for your depression?
Not currently. I have for the last 6 years, maybe seven years. But my family, we all moved our separate ways, six people living in four or five different houses. We kind of went our own way, so I would have a therapist for 6 months and then move. So, you know, I didn't want to tell the story over and over again to a different therapist every six months. Right now, I don't have therapy.
What do you want? What do you need?
I don't know. I guess time helps all of this right now. I want to get better, and I'm happy with the way things are right now. My parents are back together. They're married. That makes me feel better. My siblings all seem to be doing fine. I think I wanted someone to look out for me during those years, and no one was there to look out until I got in trouble for things. And then my parents would be there as parents.
When you got into trouble, which is pretty typical for family systems who are broken.
Right. I don't know what I need now, but I think I needed that then.
Well, is there still that longing for someone to look out for you?
It's really hard to say.
Well,
I guess a little bit.
I'll tell you this. If you're human, the answer is yes, because I think all of us have a little bit of that longing. It's louder or quieter depending on the day and depending on the moment in our lives. Of course, it's still in there with you. Thank you.
Sure.
Robin, you had said what was going on in the family back then felt like walking on eggshells.
Absolutely. With both my mom and my dad.
Why?
Because, you know, I would come home after school and my mom would say, clean up the house. Your dad's going to come home. You know, he's going to be all upset. Just clean up. You know, do your homework. And it felt like we couldn't just relax like we used to. We would come home. I would come home. My mom would say, oh, how was your day? You know, we'd sit on the couch. And now it was like, oh my gosh, you know, there's so much stuff to do. And, you know, and actually my dad was home now because, you know, after the accident, he was actually living in a hospital bed in our living room. And, you know, there were so many things to do. But then when my dad got better, he was home with us. And it was nice. You know, my mom wasn't stressed out like she used to be, but she was also mad at my dad because he wasn't there for her emotionally. He was there for her now. He could take us places and do things and make dinner. But he wasn't there for my mom. He was kind of in denial. I think my dad felt like, you know, he lived and he almost felt like he didn't have a problem anymore.
What was it like for you when your mom asked your dad to move out?
Well, I blame my mom. I said, Mom, you can't just let Dad move out. You know, you can't just give up on him. He needs us. And my mom said, you know, I need to be healthy.
Robin, I didn't quite hear. You said, I couldn't tell whether you said I blamed my mom or I blame my mom.
No, I blamed my mom back then. I blamed her. I don't blame her now. I'm proud of my mom. Now that I can, you know, in retrospect, I look back and say, wow, my mom dealt with so much. And I wasn't there for her. You know, I was out with my friends. I stayed out of the house. I didn't want to deal with it. I would come home late at night, and my mom would be worried about me, and I didn't care.
David, let's bring you back into the discussion here. And what I'm hearing is what happens almost whenever any parent is vulnerable in the family, and it's not talked about. I'm hearing, you know, eggshells and cancer, something just eats away at everybody. And I don't know if we're talking about specifically here about depression or just this silent vulnerability.
I think it's worse with depression because there is the whole issue of social isolation of the family, that because there is the stigma and the difficulty talking to other people about what's going on, that makes it much harder for the family to cope. What I'm hearing is very similar to a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder, only it affected the whole family, this sense of numbing, of being socially isolated, disconnected, feeling like things could recur at any moment, the kind of intrusive thoughts people have about a traumatic situation. And it really, when somebody attempts suicide, it's not clear what the family should do. To what extent should they take care of the person, or should they take care of themselves? The decisions that were made in this circumstance, I think, are very understandable. And the kids' reactions of why did my mom do this and should she have done something differently is understandable as well. It's not clear what the proper course of action is when a trauma like this has occurred to a family.
Okay, so I want to go back and I want to ask them what happened, and then I want to come back and hear about your protocol, okay? And Patricia, let's start with you here. You took John back. Why?
Mm-hmm. A few years ago, one of our children had depression, and I did the best I could, but I thought the only person that could possibly understand is John, who had been there. And I asked John if he would come back one night to just sort of help out, and he did. And then I said, would you stay one more night? And he did. And after 5 days, I saw him coming down the street with a U-Haul truck, and he had moved himself back in. So once again, there was no negotiating, no discussion. We just moved back in together to help our son. And even that wasn't a good idea about not talking about things. You know, just to bring us back together to help one of the kids, that was helpful, but we didn't deal with it the right way again.
Right. But I'm hearing that the fact that you moved back together was John's doing. Was it 100% John's doing, or were you secretly, quite silently involved in making it okay for him to move back in?
It made things better for me when he moved back in, because I was being brought into Ryan's depression as well. I mean, just it pained me so much to see Ryan, I thought, maybe following the same path that John had been in. So I was glad John was back.
What kind of therapy did you get as a family, or did you?
We really never got good family therapy over these 9 years. The kids were all scattered, Philadelphia, Chalfont, Ursinus College. So we tried all this piecemeal, but we never had any consistent therapy that lasted more than a month.
Regret? Do you regret that?
I think I tried over and over again to find therapy, but nobody really wanted to do it together. So I think the biggest regret is that it wasn't taken care of way back in the very beginning.
Yeah, that's hard to hear, especially for a family therapist, listening to those words. Let's turn to you, David.
Mm-hmm.
What would you have liked to have seen happen, and what kind of work do you do with families where there's depression?
Well, one of the things I would have liked to have seen, I would have liked to have gotten the family together a couple of weeks after the suicide attempt and really educate the family about what they've just been through, not in necessarily in an informational way, but to get the family to each talk about what had just happened and why, to get John to be talking about what his depression consisted of, what the causal factors were, and each member of the family to reflect on how it affected them and how they've been responding to it, how they would recognize when he was getting depressed again, what would be good things to do as a family if that were true, what treatments should they be looking for, what's the role of medication, not only for John, but other members of the family if they become depressed, to really get an open discussion going of this disorder from a medical vantage point, its causes, its prognosis.
And when you talk about it like that, as a medical illness that's actually a brain disorder, it really takes away shame and blame, doesn't it? It's simply,
I think, it reduces shame and blame. I don't think it erases it entirely, because, for example, when you talk about the genetics of the disorder, some parents feel guilty that maybe they've passed the genes on to their kids. And or you can get mothers and fathers arguing about who contributed the gene. There can be nevertheless guilt when there is a biological illness. But I think it goes a long way towards reducing guilt, because people start thinking about depression in the same way they might think of diabetes or arthritis or asthma or any number of other medical disorders that require an ongoing treatment.
But here we have, okay, so now you've got a family that has this medical knowledge, and hopefully shame and blame are diminished. But, you know, we've got 2 of 4 children here, and there's 4 people in the studio. And during this crisis, and probably even now to a large extent, all of them have very specific needs that are very loud and very important. I mean, yes. They really need to be addressed. How is that done?
How should that be done?
Yeah.
Well, I think you have to think about depressive illness as a recurrent, ongoing disorder. I think the mistake we sometimes make as mental health professionals is just treating an episode and only treating the person with the episode, giving them medication, sending them on their way, maybe giving them a little bit of counseling until they're no longer depressed. But the effects of the illness, as we've seen, have a rippling effect on members of the family who often need their own therapy, sometimes their own medications, or at least a support group. And also the illness is recurrent. We know that 70% of people who've had a depressive episode go on to have a second one. And I think families are empowered when they recognize that eventuality, particularly when they're able to spot when the person is cycling into a depression and know who to call and what to do as a family to try to prevent it from getting worse.
Yeah, and to pick up on the early signs. In our few seconds, I have left. I just want to check in with the Gallagher, see how everybody is. Robin, how are you after this hour here?
I really feel good. I feel like we just told our story, and you know, hopefully this helps other people.
Are you breathing? Are you continuing to breathe?
I'm breathing,
fairly
yes.
Deeply, you're getting enough oxygen in
I
there.
I am. Thank you.
Caitlin?
I feel good. I never thought I would see my sister crying over this because she's always isolated herself. So it's nice to see some emotion run through. And I hope that we can help people who are listening out there, too.
And in just a couple of seconds, John, how was this for you?
I thought it was wonderful. It was tremendously healing for my family. And again, my mission is to try to help as many people as I can.
And Caitlin, and I'm sorry.
This is the first time I've really heard the kids share how they feel, and I'm just so glad we're able to do that.
And it's been an honor for me. My guests today have been the Gallagher family, John, Patricia, Robin, and Caitlin, and for all of us, thank you. We're also joined by David Michlewitz. He's the author of Bipolar Disorder, A Family-Focused Treatment Approach. Well, if you want to comments or ideas, we're at voices@whyy.org. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Gita Simons helped produce today's show. Our associate producer is Elisa Walters. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends. Please take care.